Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sane, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
This is A Nation Engaged, a pre-inauguration conversation. I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm Adam Hochberg. In his victory speech 2 months ago, President-elect Donald Trump said it was time to bind the wounds of division, for Americans to come together as one united people. But those moments of conciliation have been rare, both from the president-elect and from other government leaders. And in many ways, the nation is split not only politically, but economically and culturally as well. There are few places in the country where those rifts are greater than in North Carolina, a purple state with divided leadership, where elected officials often seem unable to carry out even the most basic functions of state government without engaging in bitter partisan rancor.
Tonight, we'll talk about those divisions, but also about what binds us together as Americans. We're coming to you tonight from the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University, where we're joined by a group of about 75 people. Some are Duke students, others are members of the Triangle community. They come from diverse backgrounds and have a wide range of political beliefs. We'll be talking with them about their hopes and anxieties about the incoming Trump administration. We'll hear what they want the new president to know about their concerns and their community. And we'll talk about why we're drifting apart and whether cooperation and compromise are still possible in today's political environment.
We have with us a panel of political leaders from across North Carolina and across the ideological spectrum. Bev Perdue was North Carolina's governor from 2009 to 2013. She's a Democrat who also served 2 terms as lieutenant governor and 7 terms in the state legislature. After leaving politics, she founded DigiLearn, a nonprofit organization that promotes technology and entrepreneurship in schools. Jonathan Feltz is a Republican political veteran. He was director of political affairs for President George W. Bush and served as a senior advisor to former North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory. He's now a consultant in Raleigh. Mitch Myers is a Raleigh attorney and was a grassroots organizer for North Carolina for Donald Trump. Angela Bryant this week was sworn into her 6th term in the North Carolina legislature. She's a Democratic senator from Nash County and also served as an administrative law judge and member of the UNC Board of Governors. And Fritz Mayer is a professor here at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. He's also the director of POLIS, the Center for Political Leadership, Innovation, and Service here at Duke. Let's begin with a question for our panel, and we'll start with Mitch Myers. Mitch, what message do you think voters were sending with the results of the November election? You're the head of North Carolina for Donald Trump. Why did North Carolina go for Donald Trump?
Well, what I saw in the run to the election, at least from the polling that I saw, was the number one issue seemed to be just people wanted change. And when I look back at the last really 8 years, perhaps even longer from my perspective and from what I've seen around the state and the country, a lot of that change that was needed was an economic positive message. And part of the reason I got involved on the grassroots level trying to get Mr. Trump elected over the course of the past year is I believe that the plans that he proposed were more likely to lead to that kind of positive economic outlook than we've seen in the last 8 years. The Great Recession was pretty brutal. I know that there are statistics that show that we've somewhat recovered from that. But I've always gotten the sense in the last couple of years that the general sense of economic malaise in this country, and I feel like Trump's message was one of sort of rejuvenation.
Senator Bryant, you represent a majority African-American district up in Nash and Edgecombe and Warren counties. What did you hear from your constituents about the election?
We received a disheartening cultural message. And as a woman and a person of color and talking to people in my community, and unfortunately, this was at some level a bipartisan message, which was that if you think this is a new era of women and people of color having an equal shot at leadership in this country, that is a mistake. That white males are in charge, and we are establishing that message for you in a dramatic way. And so in our community, there was a big cultural backlash felt around both gender and race.
Now, Bev Perdue, before you were governor, you represented Craven County in eastern North Carolina. I think it's fair to say it's a moderate to conservative district.
That's more than fair.
Tell me what's happening down there. You were able to win that district as a Democrat. Now it's totally Republican.
I think the reason I could win, it was before the advent of social media, Adam. I really do think that I agree with the panelists that obviously the economy played a real role in middle America's decision to support the president-elect. And I think even though you had two 70-year-olds running for president, which was astounding in itself, you had this feeling that one of the two 70-year-olds, Hillary Clinton, represented the old guard. And there was just this hunger, as you said, for change. And I think there was also recognition because of social media that the old system, be it Democrat or be it traditionally geared to the upper class, which is where a lot of Americans voted, they felt like they were sick of that and wanted to throw it out. And social media allowed voters in Craven County and across North Carolina and across America to interact with each other in such an anonymous way. So you could say whatever you wanted to and get away with it, things that you would never say in front of your mama. And I think that carried over into the decision at the voting booth. So a lot of people who said they were going to vote one way voted another way.
Jonathan Feltz, you spent many years in Republican administrations, though you did not support Donald Trump in the primary. What do you think the message of this election was?
I think there was a couple of different messages in the election. To be clear, so I supported Jeb Bush in the primary. And I don't think there was any way possible Jeb Bush could have possibly been angry enough during this election to have connected with a lot of the American people. And I think a lot of that anger, they wanted to send a clear message. They didn't really care who the messenger was, as long as that messenger had the anger to Washington, D.C. of, we're sick and tired of what's going on up there. We want you guys to fix something. I think one of the other big things that was communicated with this election, though, was the growing divide, not between Democrat and Republican. And Governor Perdue touched on this a little bit, but the growing divide between urban and rural. That's got to be one of the most challenging obstacles facing, I think, any governor in the majority of states in this country is, look what Charlotte needs, that's different than what Nash County needs. What Davie County needs is probably different than what Raleigh needs. And so there's a lot of people in North Carolina. I'm from Davie County originally. My grandparents are from Elkin, North Carolina, big textile town. And like a lot of those jobs have been replaced, but they've not been replaced with jobs that people feel they can take a great deal of pride in. And that's, they feel like they're underemployed. And so Donald Trump, I think his message, whether you agreed with it or not, they felt like, okay, here's someone speaking for me. He's speaking in broad generalities. But most importantly, they could hear the anger in his voice, and they wanted that message conveyed to Washington, D.C., in my opinion.
So, Fritz Mayer, how polarized are we as a nation and as a state?
We're very polarized. I mean, it's hard to think of a time, certainly in my lifetime, when we've been as polarized. We're polarized by urban and rural. We're polarized by gender. We're polarized by age. We're polarized by North and South. And we're certainly polarized by party. And there's an edge to the polarization that we haven't really seen in a long time. Certainly, I can't think of a moment, perhaps in 68, where it's not just that we disagree with the other side, but certainly in this campaign, there was a sense in which the other side was illegitimate, where there was really no bonds of trust. It is the case that we're polarized. We've sorted in a way the parties are. There's very little overlap, very few people in the middle now who are elected, and we could talk about why that's the case. But there's also this edge to it, kind of language that delegitimizes the other that we really haven't seen before. And that, to me, is the really worrying thing about the state of our politics.
Okay. Let's hear from our audience. Here's Asma.
I'm with Carla Jimenez. Carla, can you stand up just so folks can see who you are? And are you a student here?
No, I am a graduate student at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
And so, Carla, you had written that the country is a rapidly shifting demographic place at this point in time. That interested me, having covering a lot of demographics this year. Why does that sort of concern you in terms of when you were talking about what you want the next president to know?
Well, because we're hearing about this need for great change in the government, in all of America, but a lot of the changes that have been proposed are based on old, past traditions. And considering how we are rapidly evolving and how our ideals are shifting into something that is an amalgamation of different cultures and different ways of operating, we can't get stuck by going back into the past and operating in those old ways. We have to figure out a way to move together as a nation by listening to each other and figuring out new ways to solve problems at the policy level.
So, Mitch, I want to pose this to you. Sort of, how do you respond when you hear the idea that you feel, I guess, Carla, speaking about the president-elect, that the policies are traditionalist in a world in which the country, I should say, is changing demographically?
Well, I think you can make a distinction between economics and culture. I don't think that they're intertwined. I think that by having a stronger economy, you give an opportunity for people from all cultures to thrive. I don't see that as being, having a good economy as being a form of separating people. I view that as a form of coming together. And when Trump talks about making America great again, he's talking about all Americans. I feel, at least the people on my side have felt, that identity politics have been far too prevalent in our national discussion for too long. And it's, you know, every conservative I know is very fond of other cultures. You know, the perception out there that we're intolerant in some ways, I think, is flawed. I think what the way most conservatives view this is preserve your culture, celebrate your culture, but overall, we're all Americans. And I think Trump's economic message reached beyond those cultural divides, that identity politics. And, you know, if that's traditional, I don't think there's a problem with that. I think that that touched a positive nerve with a lot of people.
Do you understand at all why some folks feel concerns about Donald Trump and identity politics, or do you feel that he was devoid of identity politics?
Well, I don't think the election was devoid of identity politics. It's certainly hard to avoid it. It was an issue. It's been an issue for, you know, elections as far back as I can remember. What I think the difference is, like I said before, is that people are tired of emphasizing our differences. And I think, at least from my perspective and most of my conservative friends' perspective, Trump was a breath of fresh air in the sense that he didn't emphasize those differences. He emphasized, again, us as Americans. And, you know, when Trump says make America great again, everybody can interpret that any way they want. I mean, we're all different, and we all have a different perception of what makes America great again. But I think the notion that it refers to all Americans as opposed to dividing us is really what brought people, I think, closer to that message than maybe people thought would happen at the beginning.
If we can hear Alberto, I'm with you. If you can just stand up and introduce yourself, because your card is actually a bit of an interesting story.
So my name is Alberto Ruiz. I recently moved to North Carolina 4 months ago to work as an engineer at a local LED manufacturing company. I've been quite enjoying my time in North Carolina. And so if I could say something about myself and to the president-elect, I am a son, I am a brother, a friend, a college graduate, a scientist, a volunteer, a taxpayer. I am a person passionate about technology and education. Of all these things, of all these positive things that I bring to this great nation, this great country, he chooses to define me by one dehumanizing word, illegal. I am a DACA recipient, that is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Undocumented, yes, but due to a broken immigration system. We are immigrants brought to this country with hopes to become productive members of society and follow our dreams. We are not stealing jobs from Americans. We are Americans. So I'll add this one last noun to describe myself, undocumented American. Thank you.
Do you have a particular question, or is it more that you would just like the president-elect to see you in these different ways?
I can definitely add some comments. I find it fascinating that you'll say that conservatives are tired of identity politics when there was such hateful rhetoric coming from the president-elect saying that he wants to ban all Muslims from coming to the U.S. He's retracted from that, but that is a comment that came out of his mouth. when he says that he assumes that some Mexicans are nice people during the first speech he gives, talking about himself as a candidate for presidency of the United States. And so it's bewildering for me to for you to say that you're tired of identity politics when one of the things that he played all throughout this election is us versus them for a lot of things.
I feel that I should give you, Mitch, a chance to respond, and then I'll throw it back to Adam.
When I was in fourth grade, we had a poster in our classroom. This was down in South Florida. And it was this giant cauldron. It's called the melting pot. And it had all these people falling in, and there was an American flag on the bottom underneath it. And everyone was falling in from all different cultures. They were all different colors. And I think that when you talk about identity politics, it goes both ways. Now, I don't think it's healthy to do it on either side. I can remember when Hillary called all of my side a basket of deplorables, or I think half of us were a basket of deplorables. So, you know, that kind of rhetoric is, you know, alienating and troubling on both sides. There's no question. I don't know any conservatives who have cultural issues with people who are immigrants. The issue that conservatives have is with the illegal immigration aspect, with the law enforcement aspect. You have a broken immigration system where there's no law enforcement at the border. You have 12 million illegal immigrants in this country who are here for whatever reason. They want to do well. They want to become an American. Everyone has their own motivations. But we need to make sure, and I'm speaking again for myself, I think that we need to make sure that people who come here want to do so to be Americans and to contribute to society. And the way you ensure that is by making people go through those legal hoops, to make you take the citizenship test, to make you have to go through the process to demonstrate your interest in becoming an American rather than just reaping the benefits. And I'm not saying that you're doing that. I'm not saying that millions of other Americans are doing that. I'm explaining that that's what our perspective is.
A couple of other people on the panel would like to get in on this. Senator Bryant.
I just wanted to mention that this whole dialogue is very fruitful, and I'm glad you all are having it. And there's some complexity to me that I just want to give voice to, and that is the amount of denial or a blindness that is a part of this, the people who say it's just a matter of illegality. Because the same people who are concerned about the illegality, they want to go to the Hampton Inn and get a room for $79.99 instead of I'm just making up the price, instead of $139.99 because the person cleaning it is undocumented, or they want to eat vegetables at the price we get them because the people who are harvesting them are undocumented, or they want a manicure a lawn at half the price they'd have to pay for it if the people doing it, and I don't mean those in a stereotypical way, but I'm trying to create an image. We all, in a sense, are participating in this economy that is driven by undocumented workers being here. And we have to all own that and decide how to manage, you know, have to own the responsibility and accountability for that, as well as our business community speaks out of both sides of its mouth as well in terms of having a role. And if they would even take the position they need to take for the workers they use, it would help the debate be a more balanced and fair debate. And it is and the sad thing is, it's a problem that can be solved. This is not a difficult problem to solve. That is to create a path for you to citizenship. But if you do that, there are people who worry you're not going to vote for them, so they don't want you to be a citizen. So there are all these self-serving power dynamics and benefits and challenges in the whole equation.
Jonathan Feltz?
I think this gets to the real heart of the challenge with this whole conversation is one of the big challenges, and I can say this experience, I had a big tech firm as a client promoting DACA, and I don't have that client anymore because I lost that client. They fired me because I couldn't get a lot of people to speak up. And that gets to the heart of the matter is folks in the middle who actually want to talk about compromise, you need to speak up and speak up loudly. You don't need to say, you know what, I don't want to deal with these folks on the left, these folks on the right. And I'm not saying extremist. I'm saying folks on the far left, far right, they've got an opinion. They've got reasons for their opinion. Folks in the middle who are looking for solutions, they've got reasons for their opinions too. But if you're not willing to speak up, and I had this client in November, December, and guess what? I mean, there was some political burnout here in North Carolina. We, you know, first time we've been a true battleground state for, you know, 18, 24 months at a time. First time we couldn't turn off or turn on the TV without seeing a political ad. There was some burnout there, but there's also people saying, you know, if I raise my voice on this, yeah, I'm going to have this guy mad at me, this person mad at me. I don't want to talk to folks at church. I don't want to hear about it at the bank. I don't want to. And so, you know, you've got to speak up. And if folks in the middle, if folks who are looking for pragmatic solutions are not willing to speak up, then you know, you deserve kind of what you get. I mean, folks need to speak up, and the idea of, like, taking a back seat anymore, that's not a viable option if you want to be solutions-oriented, in my opinion.
Governor Perdue, you mentioned social media earlier. One of the things that strikes me is that a lot of these issues we're talking about tonight, whether it's immigration, whether it's housing, there's a lot of subtlety in these issues. They're complicated things. If you're talking about, certainly health care is a very complicated issue. And a lot of this in the campaign got reduced down to 140 characters or less. It became build a wall. It became repeal Obamacare. Is there any hope anymore for an in-depth discussion of these issues that accounts for the complexities and the subtleties, or have we already fallen off that bridge and can no longer go back?
Well, I can't speak for the world's enthusiasm or embrace of social media, but I do think that the pot is boiling and people desperately want conversation and they want collaboration and reasonable decision making, Adam. And I believe that people, as I've said this for years, as my generation and folks who are older and maybe a decade younger than me begin to die out, and we will. It's just the natural life cycle. As younger people come in and as the millennials do begin to take over the political and governmental and economic structure of our country, a lot of this animosity among races and the sexual animosity, the religious animosity, will heal itself as America becomes a new melting pot. I believe that because I believe younger people, especially the under 40s, are much more inclusive and much more receptive. You've been brought up a different way. And so it's going to heal itself. And I hope with that some of you who are at Duke or at Carolina or wherever you're from or wherever you are tonight listening to this program begin to think about the very important role that education plays in the future of our country and the economy of the world. Because if we don't have people like you who are willing to take both sides of an issue and find consensus in the best perspective way that serves all of America or all of the world, then you're looking at the Third World War, and none of us want that. And so that can't be nailed down in 140 characters. It takes thoughtful, educated, compassionate people to work together to solve problems. And I believe that will happen. I'm Pollyanna. I believe it will happen. But I don't know what you do about immediately the toxicity of social media. I'm just tired of it. I don't know about you all, but I'm tired of people being able to say whatever they want to say, especially Twitter, and be done with it. And by the time you go down the chain, the responses have nothing to do with the original comment. It's just befuddling and really sad to me that people have been reduced to that kind of communication level. But then I'm an old woman.
When our community town hall meeting continues, we'll talk more about the new president, and we'll also discuss the toxic politics in our state capital. As we mentioned, the North Carolina legislature began its session this week, and instead of working together, state leaders are suing each other over the question of who is in charge. How did our state government become so dysfunctional, and what's the way out? We'll talk about that after a break. You're listening to A Nation Engaged, a pre-inauguration conversation from NPR and North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
This is A Nation Engaged, a pre-inauguration conversation. Our panel tonight includes former North Carolina Governor Bev Perdue, North Carolina State Senator Angela Bryant, Republican political consultant Jonathan Feltz, Mitch Myers of North Carolina for Donald Trump, and Fritz Mayer from Sanford School of Public Policy here at Duke University.
While Donald Trump's inauguration is still a few days away, Democrat Roy Cooper has already taken his oath of office as North Carolina's new governor. But the welcome he received from the legislature's Republican majority has been anything but warm. In a surprise special session, they voted to strip him of many of the powers that previous governors have enjoyed. Cooper has responded with a lawsuit. He also says he's not required to follow a law that prevents him from expanding Medicaid in North Carolina, and that could well result in another suit. Senator Angela Bryant, you are down at the legislature every day. What on earth is going on with our North Carolina legislature?
Multiple things. I think there is, in terms of stripping the governor of his power, I think it is basically a power struggle. And the supermajority is just not enough. So I guess there's a saying that absolute power corrupts absolutely. So it looks like our majority is in intending to make sure they have even more power than the supermajority that they have in the legislature, intruding into the executive branch power. That's one piece of it. They also argue that there were steps that Democrats took in the hundreds of years that Democrats were had majorities and Republicans were in the minority. There's lots of resentment expressed about that experience and that they're just sort of getting retribution or reparations, if you will, for the time and period that they were in the minority and that various actions were taken against Republican lieutenant governors, and in the change of power between Democratic and Republican governors, steps were taken, and they are just evening the tally on those kind of issues. So it is a power struggle, and we have to fight it tooth and nail. Our major source of fighting against it has been in the courts. We've been pretty successful in the courts, and we'll continue to fight it in the courts and in the courts of the judicial courts and in the courts of public opinion.
Fritz Meyer, we have a Republican supermajority in both the House and Senate of the legislature. That's more than 60%, and yet the vote totals in the elections are much closer than that. You've been looking into that issue. Why is that going on, and how does that contribute to the political rancor that we've seen in Raleigh?
Well, the heart of the problem is that this is a purple state in terms of the electorate. It's almost perfectly balanced. It voted for President Obama in 2008, for President Trump this time out, but it's really quite balanced, and yet you have a supermajority. Why is that? Short answer, gerrymandering. In 2010, Republicans won election just at the moment when we redistrict. And so with the magic of computers, we're really able to draw lines that ensure that the majority becomes a supermajority. And this is a huge problem. Not only is the delegation not representative of the state as a whole in terms of the balance, but very few members of the state legislature really are in competitive districts. And what does that mean? That means that you really don't face much of a penalty if you are simply obstinate, if you block things. The game is really the primary, not the general. And so instead of having a competitive district where you really need to think, you need to talk to both sides, you really need to kind of come towards the middle position, we're in a situation now in which, in fairness on both sides, but because Republicans drew the lines, they have the supermajority, where there's almost no political penalty paid for being obstinate and exercising your power. And Senator Bryant's right. This is about power and the seizing of power. And we could talk about the history and the way in which this escalates. But I think the fundamental problem is at heart a question of gerrymandering and the way in which we've drawn our district lines, which is, well, unless we fix that, it's going to be very, very difficult to change the tenor of politics in North Carolina.
So I'm here now with Madison Lateson. And Madison, you're the vice chair at the Duke College Republicans. And you had an interesting comment here. You said specifically, Trump, don't give up on millennials. What do you mean by that, and what do you want him to hear about your generation?
Yes, well, you know, Adam asked the question to the audience, you know, what do you want the new administration to hear from you and your community? And as a millennial Republican, that's the message that I want to send to Trump and all Republicans who have been elected. There's definitely a perception, and it's, you know, not completely unwarranted, that almost all millennials are liberal. And while that's true, as the vice chair of the Duke College Republicans this year, I've seen unprecedented levels of growth in our numbers and higher levels of engagement and enthusiasm than we've seen in recent years. So while I'm afraid that the Republican Party is in danger of losing millennials in the long run. I don't think that has to be the case. I think there's a lot of potential for the party to grow in our generation.
Should we pose that maybe to Jonathan? I mean, do you hear a lot from younger conservatives, younger Republicans? And if so, what are you hearing from them?
I mean, short answer is yes. I think that millennials and how to communicate with millennials is one area of bipartisan agreement between Democrats and Republicans, and that any of us over 40 don't know how to do it. You know, the idea of like texting everything or tweeting everything, like it exhausts me just thinking about it, so to speak. But just, I mean, look, it's, I mean, it's, you know, there's always a generational, you know, the generational gap. I mean, it's not a cliche. It really exists, and it's existed for a long time, not just with millennials. But, you know, I mean, as a Republican, I think we do have to communicate better with millennials. But I don't think the party has given up on millennials. I think we have a lot of outreach efforts. I think, I mean, look, I mean, a lot of folks in leadership roles, we're not very hip on the Republican Party, and so yeah, we have a hard time communicating with you. But I think from a policy position, I mean, we might not always communicate. And yeah, there are some things that we and like gay marriage is a good example where you know, a lot of younger Republicans, millennials, have a much different outlook on that than what folks, you know, my age or older might have, especially growing up in the Southeast necessarily. But I think there's plenty of other areas where there's a lot of agreement because, I mean, folks do want to be competitive. They do want to have opportunities for everyone. They do want to find a way to bridge different gaps, including the, as I keep talking about, urban versus rural divide and everything like that. And so, you know, we are a bit flummoxed with it, but I don't think it's from due to our policy positions. I think it's just a function of, like I said, we're not good at communicating with you. And we're trying, but it's a bit of a work in progress, I think.
I'm here also now with another person who has an interesting comment. This is David Wolliver Sanchez. David, you talk here a bit about being concerned about how we listen to one another if we are living in an era in which there is sometimes fake news.
Sure. So one thing that I've been very concerned about this election cycle is that people seem to be living in very different realities. So you have people on the right and people on the left and people in the middle watching very different things, like cable news or on the internet. And that makes it very difficult for us to find that sort of common ground that we talk a lot about. So when we're engaging in political discourse, my concern is that we're not going to be able to find that common ground as long as heavily biased news is seen as credible or fake news continues to be spread so widely on the internet.
Let's pose that to you, Governor Perdue. You talked a bit earlier about social media and having a run for governor in a different era. I mean, how do you respond to David?
You're only as good as the your ability to listen to others. I truly believe that, and I think that your generation and the millennials in general are really much better than that than we really think you are. I'm intrigued by a dinner at my house with 8 children around a table, all in their late 30s and 40s, and the conversations they have and the depth of the conversations. And then I go to a table at Duke, or, you know, I was at Harvard for a while, and I like nothing better than to go out and sit with the students. And they are so provocative, and you all are so provocative, and you do engage, and you're not hurt. You don't get angry when people don't believe with you and disagree with you. And those are the kind of conversations you have to have. Again, as you leave academia and start your own world of work and have kids and a job and all those responsibilities, I think you'll find, like most of us, that time for really intense, provocative conversation is limited. And then you tend to go to people in your own social circles who think more like you. You know, this hadn't been discussed tonight, but I was intrigued. We were traveling with several couples late this summer, and I was obviously on the Hillary bandwagon and was trying to talk these people who are my great social friends and educated friends into being for Hillary. And I was just amazed to hear the rationale that they had to vote for President-elect Trump. And it was really not political or policy. It was all about the Supreme Court. So people have hugely different reasons for saying and believing what they do. And that takes conversation. It doesn't take 160 characters or a quick text the way most of us communicate now.
I have a question for Professor Mayer. We've talked a lot in this group, and we tend to idealize the concept of moderation, compromise, both sides working together. And yet, when you look at what's happening, especially in Washington, there does not seem to be a great penalty for those members of Congress who firmly plant themselves on one side or the other. So we had the Republican congressional majority say that they would not hold hearings on President Obama's Supreme Court nominee. Whether you agree with that position or don't agree with it, you would have to agree that that is a very extreme position that no Congress had ever exercised before. And yet, that was not something that hurt most of those members of Congress. There does not seem to be at the ballot box a groundswell of people saying, I'm not voting for you, you are not willing to compromise enough. In fact, we often see the opposite, where people are primaried because they are too moderate. So is our obsession about moderation and compromise in touch with what the voters really want?
What's interesting, voters say they want moderation and compromise, and voters say that they want the system to work. They're frustrated with the gridlock. They say they don't want that. But we've organized partly, and certainly not, we've organized our politics in ways, again, coming back to the issue of gerrymandering in ways that make it so that you pay no penalty for being extreme. In fact, quite the contrary, if you compromise, you're seen as a traitor or as having fallen, and so you're primaried, you're vulnerable for doing that. And so the rewards actually go the other way. The incentives tend to go the other way. So this is a huge structural problem. The other pieces to this, I mean, some of this has to do with the media environment, and we've talked a bit about it. It's not just social media. It's the mainstream media as well, NPR accepted, of course, but which rewards the extreme position, the controversy that doesn't really reward people for being more moderate in their views. It likes controversy. That's what sells. The other thing I would point to, you're talking about the context in Washington. I worked in the Senate for Bill Bradley, Democrat from New Jersey, in another era, and it was the case there, and I think in North Carolina as well, that there was a lot more personal interaction across the aisle than exists today. People knew each other and were friends. I mean, famously, Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, of course, well known. But that was common, that people knew each other. And just as Governor Perdue was just saying, when you're traveling with people, when you're spending time with people socially and other ways, it changes the way you interact with people. And so we've kind of sorted ourselves socially as well. I think that's true in North Carolina. And it's true in the country. And that's why conversations like this, I think, are just so important, that we have opportunities to see each other, look each other in the eye, hear somebody's story, realize that they have a legitimate story, they understand where they're coming from. That's something that's super important, and we need to find ways to do more of that, I think, if we want to get out of this bind.
Mitch Myers, do you want Donald Trump to compromise and find middle ground with Democrats?
I absolutely do. And I think that the difference that we're talking about is between compromise to advance your position or your philosophical goal or your policy goal versus compromise for the sake of compromise. I think part of the reason that conservatives went for Donald Trump is because they don't see him as someone who will compromise and sacrifice his principles in the process, that his overall policy goals he's going to promote. Whereas if you look, you know, from our perspective anyway, you look back to, for example, Senator Rubio, he ran as a Tea Party candidate. He was anti-illegal immigration. And then he sponsored the Gang of Eight bill. You know, to conservatives, that I'm not addressing the merits of the bill, but to conservatives, that looks like you're compromising not to advance your principles, your goals, you're compromising for the sake of compromise. And that's not to say that we don't, speak for myself, that's not to say that I don't want to see compromise by President-elect Trump. I do. I just want it to be reasonable, and I don't want it to be done in a way that sacrifices the reasons for which most people voted for him.
Senator Bryan, what about in your heavily Democratic district. Do your voters want you to compromise with Republicans, or they want you to fight, fight, fight?
I think similarly to what Mitch says there, I have a strong contingent of supporters who want me to fight, 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 and not compromise, even in the minority. And then there are some who are excited to have a reasonable solution. We had a very polarizing debate in my community that had a partisan tinge to it around the dismantling of our merged county school system. And we ended up in a compromise that saved the system. And there are people who were upset on either ends of that compromise, but I think most people pleased that we were able to save it. I wanted to make an additional point, though, about this level of polarization and compromise. I think there is, in my mind, a racial component to this, and I want to see if I can connect these dots quickly. In that, for example, around redistricting, there are ways in which the racial progress we've made around redistricting is being turned against us. The Republicans say, okay, you won the right to these majority-minority districts so you can elect African-Americans. Great. We'll give you the most African-Americans you ever had in the history of North Carolina. But you'll be permanently in the majority, and your ability to coalesce with people of other races. You'll be permanently in a minority, I'm sorry, and your ability to coalesce with other members of other races will be lessened. So the racial dynamics add to the polarization. We hear statements in the legislature, this is a republic. There isn't this interest in democratic principles, that is fairness, giving all of us an opportunity to have our citizens represented, including everyone. There isn't that level of interest anymore. It's about this republicanism, the representative system, which is bolstered by the gerrymandering, and maintaining this power, the last gasp of this power by the basically the people in the European white, soon-to-be minority when you add all the various people of color together. So that's how some people in my area experience this dynamic and think it is at the root of some of this polarization, and that's kind of irrational. That level of engagement around feelings around race can lead to some other irrational kind of decision making. And we're seeing the results of that, I believe.
We just heard Angela talk about race, and I'm joined now by Kirk Montgomery. Kirk, can you stand up? Your question seems to suggest that you have some concerns about the era that we will be entering in based on what Donald Trump's campaign slogan was and what he was calling for. What are your concerns?
My concerns are basically that Donald Trump came about saying, make America great again. And to me, it seems it's more make America hate again because of all the racial disbursement that's happening within inside of the whole country. And so what I'm trying to figure out is that, you know, how can we unite when a president is saying, okay, let's build a wall, you know, let's ban Muslims, let's do all these things that are not of the American people. So my concern is I just want him to know that we as Americans, and me especially as an African American, you know, we saw for the last 8 years we had an African American president. He made great strides in helping the race relationships across the United States. But now he's coming in and a lot of people are feeling that, okay, making America great again is making America white again. And that's my concern and my worries.
Can we pose that, I guess, to Governor Perdue? I mean, I'd like to hear from a Democrat as well as a Republican on how, I mean, what would your advice be to Donald Trump? How do you unite the country at this point?
My advice to the president-elect would be for him to be more thoughtful and to put away his Twitter vocabulary. I do strongly believe that there is real racial divisiveness in this country. I believe that. I believe the things that in the campaign that were said about women were despicable things. But I'm hopeful because this is America, after all. And at the end of the day, all of us in this room and listening to this broadcast are Americans. And just as I feel about North Carolina, it's time for the legislature and the new governor to think first about North Carolina and not about their peculiar or partisan proclivities. I urge the president-elect to think the same thing and to adopt that philosophy that this is not about all the words I've said in the campaign. If I do well as president, I can get reelected if that's his priority. For him, the next 4 years have to be about America and Americans, all of us, regardless of our sex, race, creed, or color. It's got to be about making America work again for all of us and giving all of us equal opportunity at the heights of power. And if he would do that, I would be the first one to cheer him on. I have hope until January 21st that that might happen. And I believe as Americans, we must hope that. Because if I don't hope success for him, I'm no better off than some of the things that were said in this very divisive campaign. We all have to want the best for our country. And we have a president-elect we need to go in to this cycle supporting and praying every day that he does well. Because if he does well, all of us do well.
Mitch, can we pose the same question to you real briefly? What would your advice be to Donald Trump about uniting the country?
Well, I've seen him speak in person. I've seen him speak on television. And I truly believe that he wants what's best for all Americans. I've never gotten a sense from him that he thinks any differently. I truly believe the man loves the country. We all do. And I think we all want more or less the same things. I think we differ on how we go about that. And I think that we just need to be open-minded and not make presumptions. As I said before, we talk about the slogan, Make America Great Again. And, sir, you have a completely different perspective on what that means than I do, and that's fine. We all do. It's a very broad topic. But I think what it comes down to is we all want what's best for the country, including President-elect Trump. And I think we just need to give him the benefit of the doubt and see what happens. There's nothing else we can do.
One final question that comes to us from Connie Purvis. Connie, your comments interested me because you talked both about what you want the president-elect to know, and then you also talked about compromise. So how do you think that we compromise at this juncture?
Well, I think it's important to realize that when facts are presented clearly and without media bias, which is very difficult, but social media is helping with that, that we find that we're more united than we are divided on most things. I think that we have to look that debate and division have always been present in U.S. politics. Look back at the Jefferson versus Adams campaign in 1776. Debate is healthy, and compromise is not always needed. But when it is, it's good if we can get the facts and present them clearly. And I think we find that all of us basically end up wanting the same things, which are freedom, safety, rule of law, and the opportunity to just live and work together peacefully. And I think that would be very good for him to know.
You mentioned also that you're a conservative, but you differ, it seems a bit, with the president-elect ideologically, and you want him to know that?
I think it's important that he would know and that everyone knows that true conservatives are not racist and don't condone racist rhetoric or isolationist, but we are capitalist and conservatives and constitutionalist, and we want everyone to have the opportunity to reach their fullest potential, and we feel that less government involvement in our daily lives is a way to attain that goal. And I think it's important that he see the overall picture of the responsibilities that the president needs to have as far as safety, protection, but maybe getting out of the minutia control that seem to burden people.
Fritz, maybe you could talk to us a bit about the notion of compromise. I mean, do you feel like there is a particular issue that we can envision compromise on in the near future, given the conversation that we've been hearing both tonight and broadly around the country this election cycle?
Well, I think there's possibilities for compromise on a lot of issues. I think, as was just said, in fact, if we talk long enough, we discover we're not as far apart as we think we are, and we've been led to believe, and for a lot of reasons, the differences get accentuated. So I think there's that possibility. I do think that it requires leadership of a particular kind, and if I had a hope for President-elect Trump, soon President Trump,
he would, in the words of Lincoln, appeal to the better angels of our nature, as opposed to what I think it's fair to say he's sometimes pretty thin-skinned and reactive and says things in tweets that are unnecessarily divisive and off point. I think there is a hunger out there in the public now for a different kind of leadership. I think people are tired of the division, notwithstanding all that's been said here. And I think with a certain kind of leadership, and I share Governor Perdue's hope that President-elect Trump will provide that. We could walk through a variety of issues, but what it takes is a willingness to really listen to the other side with an open mind and to accept the possibility that there's some information that the other person has that might actually change your mind, and not to be just sure that we have a monopoly on the truth. We have to be humble. None of us have a monopoly on the truth. And so to me, a certain measure of humility, maybe that's a tall task for President-elect Trump, I don't know, but humility and a kind of a gentler tone that doesn't see enemies at every turn. And I'm an optimistic person. I think if you look at our history, when we've seen a problem as a country, we've figured out a way out of it. And my optimism is that we, having identified this as a problem, our politics as a problem, that we will somehow together through conversations like this and others find our way out of this.
We'll let that optimism be our last word tonight. Thank you, Fritz Mayer. Thank you to all of our panelists for being part of our discussion this evening. And a special note of appreciation to the members of the community who joined us here at Duke University to engage in a civil conversation. Thank you all very much. Our program tonight was engineered by Al Wadarski. Liz Baer managed our social media, and our production assistant was Liz Schlemmer. I'm Adam Hochberg.
And I'm Asma Khalid. Our town hall event was hosted by POLIS, the Center for Politics, Leadership, Innovation, and Service at Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy. You've been listening to A Nation Engaged, a pre-inauguration conversation from NPR.